We are in the third week of a four-week group on the four foundations of mindfulness. And I'm going to just very briefly, for those of you who weren't here for the first two, to go over a little bit just what mindfulness is. Thankfully, the third one, which we're talking about tonight, is the one the Buddha had the least to say about. And most teachers have very little to say about this, too. You'll see why. The basic idea of mindfulness is that from a very young age, we are taught, we train ourselves to look for all the answers to our stress and suffering outside. When a baby is cold, it cries out and it's brought a blanket. When we're hungry, we cry out, we're brought food, hopefully. So there's a sense when there's an inner state of discomfort, we become stressed, and then we look for an external solution. And of course, for food and cold and when you're sick, getting medicine, there are certain internal states that are helped by externals. But the Buddha taught that we do spend far too much of our lives looking for the answers to internal states outside that cannot be solved outside in the external world. For example, one way to go into this is to bring up the example of very often when we're in a park on a Sunday and it's a beautiful day and we think, oh, this is great. I love going to the park on a Sunday. It's the best thing. So we're making the fact that we feel good, we're pinning the cause on the park or the fact that it's Sunday. But really what's going on is just on Sundays when we're not working and we're not trapped in an office and we're outdoors, we give ourselves permission to relax the body. We don't fill up the mind with obsessive thoughts about what's going to happen to me in the future, what do other people think about me, how's my career going. We create the internal conditions that allow ourselves to feel good. It's not the park that's doing that, it's you that's doing that inside. It's an internal cause. But we tend to say, oh, it's created by the park or the beach or whatever. And if we're doing something that we find we have an aversion towards, for example, paying taxes, moving, going to the dentist, going to work on Monday morning, I don't know what. You all have your own list. I know I do. We tend to blame the fact that we are stressed out, we're miserable or lonely or upset on what's going on around us in the world. One of the things that the Buddha said, though, is that we actually tend to bring a lot of the suffering with us into these situations and create the suffering. It's not so much this person, person A, is a difficult person that's causing our stress, our misery, our discomfort or anger. It's the fact that we bring these expectations, this defensiveness, this underlying physical stress, these gut feelings of, oh, I have to deal with this person again, and this sense of thoughts about why do I have to deal with this situation, and we create unwittingly the causes and conditions of the fact that we find all these things in life really unpleasant. It's not so much the externals, which we tend to give 100% credit to, it's actually all the underlying attitudes that we bring to it. Now, that's not to say that all of the causes of our suffering are internal. The Buddha didn't say that. The Buddha said that the only things we have real control over, though, the only thing we can do anything about is what's going on inside. You cannot change the people around you. You cannot change your co-workers. You can try, but it's probably not going to work. You can't change your the people you cohabitate with, the people that your roommates, you can't change your family, you can't change the president or the ex-president or the whoever. You can't change that. You can put effort into it, and there's nothing wrong with putting effort into it, but if when it comes to the redundant sufferings that we have in our day-to-day lives, the greatest effectivity we can have in reducing our suffering will always be putting a good deal of effort into seeing what's happening inside. Now, there's, again, nothing wrong with trying to change the system, trying to bring equality, trying to dismantle a completely oppressive institutions. There's so many oppressive institutions. The government is oppressive. Virtually everything you're surrounded with is oppressive, right? But if you want to have the greatest effect on reducing suffering in your life, a good place to start would be to make sure that you're not bringing stress and anger and defensiveness and contraction into every endeavor in your life. If you are peaceful and calm within, you'll reduce the amount of stress and suffering you're bringing to life, and then you can be effective and wise in the way you deal with the world. So this makes us more effective if we want to engage in social activism. It's not either or. It's just that having a calm internal state is the greatest foundation for happiness. It's the place to start. So, mindfulness is the four places that the Buddha said we should be aware of if we want to reduce the suffering and stress that we're bringing into all the situations in our lives. All these places within that we bring tightness and contraction and tension and defensiveness and doubt and building up walls and all that, they're all within. And the Buddha said there's four places to look and to work with. The first is rupa, which means just the ambient body states. How is the breath right now? How does your body feel the way you're sitting? Just what are the ambient body states? A lot of times when we're stressed out at work, if we look at the way we're breathing, we'll see that we're breathing very shallow and in a way where we're not encouraging ourselves to have a comfortable internal state. The posture might be somewhat uncomfortable, leaning forward into the computer. Sometimes I'll find myself with, it looks like my nose almost pressed up against the screen, and I have to constantly, mindfully relax the body, relax the things that I do, so that the posture and the underlying breath and the state of the body is as relaxed as it can be. That's the first. And the second, which we talked about last week, is gut feelings. As opposed to the ambient body state, gut feelings are those areas in the body where you hold your emotions, where you hold your anger, your resentment, or perhaps just your feelings of, I don't like what's going on, or I really like what's going on. Gut feelings are an embodied state of the way that the unconscious talks to us. It talks to us through the body and lets us know when we're uncomfortable with someone or with a certain situation, and when we're comfortable with a certain situation. Some people hold their stress in their stomachs, I do. Some people in their shoulders get all tight and bunched up when they don't like what's going on. Some people, their jaws get really tense or start, working away. Some people, their throats get really tight, like they're strangling themselves. Some people, it goes on and on and on. We all hold, all of us have a way that our body reacts or responds to cortisol, which is the stress hormone that the amygdala in the brain releases when we are in fear or in aversion, or the other hormones that the hypothalamus releases when we're in craving. So there's the ambient body states and the gut feelings. The first two forms of mindfulness, therefore, are about things in the body. Ambient body states, gut feelings are in the body. The next two, the third and fourth things we're asked to be mindfully aware of, are in the mind. So we're making the transition this week from the body to the mind. The third thing the Buddha asks us to be aware of is known as citta, which means the overall state of the mind. And the fourth one is called dhammas, which really roughly means what you're thinking about. So how do we delineate or separate thoughts from the mind? It sounds somewhat simple, but most people get stuck up on this. I've heard a lot of teachers who seem to not even really get it. It actually, I've spent a lot of time with monks talking about this, and I got a pretty solid foundation this after years and years and years. Basically, citta, the third foundation, is the overall mood that you're in, as opposed to any specific thought. A way to think of this is, today it was sort of gray and cloudy when we woke up. Or, you know, yesterday it was gray and overcast and rainy. So that's the overall weather. The thoughts, though, the fourth foundation, are what specifically is happening at any given time. The rain, the raindrops, or maybe a breeze. So the mind, the third foundation is just the overall sky. And the fourth, the thoughts, are the clouds that are floating through the mind. Another way to think of it is the third foundation is like a river. A river can be cold, it can be clear, it can be cloudy, it can be warm, it can be cold. That's the overall state of the river. The thoughts, though, are the branches and fish and things that are swimming through it at any one given time. So your thoughts are the content that you're having, the thoughts, the ideas. The mind is the overall mood that you're in. It's larger than your thoughts. Does this make any sense? Does that mean everybody? Okay. Because it's funny how many people don't get this or how poorly it's been conveyed over the years. So long as you get the idea that the third foundation is being aware of the overall mood of the mind. What mood are you in? What state is the mind in? As opposed to what ideas or thoughts that are going through it at any given moment. They're definitely interrelated. Now, the Buddha said with mindfulness, once we know what foundation we're working on, there's three things we have to do. And they are called sati, sampujana, and atapa. Let me say that again. Sati, sampujana, and atapa. Sati means remembering, oh, I shouldn't get only caught up in the world around me. I should bring my awareness within and see what's going on. Is my body stressed? Is my gut feelings? Is my stomach tight? My shoulders up? I should see what's going on inside of me. Sampujana is just once I'm looking in, I become aware and I sit with and observe whatever's happening without being reactive, which means immediately getting upset. Sometimes we go inside and we'll see that the body's all tight and we'll go, oh my God, I don't like it in there very much. I want to go back out into the outside world. A lot of people I know hate being alone, especially people who are young, because when they're alone, they feel so uncomfortable in their skin. And when they feel uncomfortable in their skin, they need to surround themselves with diversions. That's what other people do for us. They give us permission not to focus on what's going on inside of us. So in order to do this, you have to get comfortable in your own skin. That's what a lot of this practice is about. And the third thing is atapa, which is to once we've remembered what to look at, we've observed it, then after a while we work with whatever we can to relax it, to make the underlying state more peaceful, so that we aren't bringing stress to our lives, so that we aren't bringing suffering into our interactions. So many times we say and we do things we regret because underneath we're stressed out. And so when somebody comes towards us and interacts with us, we're already so worked up with all the things we have to pay attention to, this underlying sense of stress, the body's uncomfortable, the mind's filled with chatter and thought, that somebody who comes into our life is seen as another just thing that's causing stress to an already stressful situation, and we just try to make people go away, or we say something that we regret because we are already trying to just get this suffering that's inside of us out. When people create violence, when they hurt other people, it's because they are deeply, deeply suffering, deeply uncomfortable, and they're trying to get that discomfort out by taking it out on somebody else. So this practice of looking at what's going on beneath or underneath or inside is such an important practice. It keeps us from causing harm, from saying things that we'll regret, from acting reactively, from being defensive and doing things that get us into trouble, etc. It's a very important practice. So the Buddha said, when it comes to the mind, here's what we look for. I wrote down a list of five different things, and if you look at the Satipatthana, you can find them. The Buddha said, first, when you are aware of the mind, just notice if there's a general sense of anger. And that would mean you'll notice that a lot of thoughts that have been going through your mind have been about how everybody around you is acting like a shit, you know, blah, blah, blah. How there's this sense of pushing away, wishing everybody would go away, wishing we would be just left alone. The sense of, in the mind, is just trying to push everyone away. Why can't they just leave me all alone? It's not even said that much. It's just a feeling in the mind of being under attack and everybody else is to blame, right? So that's the first state of mind. The second state of mind is when there's craving. And the exact opposite feeling goes on here. Here the mind feels empty. There's something missing. There's a sense of hollowness in life, a sense of purposelessness, a sense of missing. We're missing something, so we're looking for something in the world to fill us up, to make us feel complete. Something in the mind feels like we're not enough. The mind feels like it doesn't have enough. So the first two, anger, is a sense that we're under attack by people, the world. Why don't you all go away? The second is a sense of the exact opposite. I'm missing something. I'm hollow inside. There's like just an absence there. There's not enough. I need to fill it up. The third is noticing whether the mind has too much energy. Is the mind jumping around from one perception or thought to another? Is your mind like a leaping, like a frog from one thing to another? Is it, you know, hopping around? One monk I heard used the example of you see an inchworm on a leaf, and then it keeps on moving, and then it's like its legs are over the edge, and it's, you know, it has to keep on moving, and then finally another leaf comes, and it'll go wherever that leaf leads it, and then it'll keep on moving. There's a sense that it can never just sit. So that's the third state of mind. Is the mind really filled with so much energy? Are we agitated? We can't settle down. We can't focus. The mind is like a remote control that's constantly being clipped. And so many people, of course, have this as a result of not only, of course, the amount of sugar that we take in, but also just our lifestyles. You know, not only remote controls with TVs, but the Facebook thing where, you know, we're on computers and there's a million different ways people can ping us at any given moment. So there's this sense of what's going on right now. Oh, that was 5 minutes ago. What's going on right now? Oh, shit, that was 2 minutes ago. What's going on right now? So that's the mind that has too much energy. The fourth is the exact opposite. The mind that feels sluggish, inert, doesn't have any energy that feels like it can't get started, it can't focus, that feeling before you have your first cup of coffee, or, you know, when you wake up and you've been lying in bed all day and you just can't get the energy to get out of bed. Nobody's ever had that feeling. That feeling of just being overwhelmed by life, and nothing that comes up can be latched onto. There's just the sense of no energy in the brain whatsoever. The fifth is, finally, when the mind feels claustrophobic, boxed in, surrounding, really tiny, and just like we're in the smallest elevator imaginable, or the mind is like this tiniest little closet, and it's just big enough to hear one thought over and over, or a couple of thoughts, or worry about one thing, and nothing else gets into us. And when people watch us, they say we're lost in the clouds because we are tripping over things on the pavement. We're totally unaware of what's going on around us. The mind is totally boxed in. I'd also add that a sixth would be the mind that's in doubt, where everything that arises we greet with cynicism and jadedness and a sense of, you know, this is not going to be of any help. But some people could just say that's just aversion of anger, aversion of just feeling being put upon. So you can view it as another state, or you can view it as part of aversion. But you get the idea. There's a number the Buddha listed of a number of underlying states that the mind can be in before we even work with the thoughts next week. Be aware, is your mind really small, or is it aware? Is the mind very tired? Is the mind over-energized, over-agitated? Is the mind filled with aversion towards everything? Do we feel put upon? Or does the mind feel empty, and is it craving something to fill it up? So these are the underlying states. And the goal is to use your spiritual tools, once you see what you've diagnosed the mind, to see what you can do in your meditation or in your practice to restore the mind to a balanced state. When people say the Buddha taught the middle path, the middle way, they didn't mean he was teaching middling effort. You know, the Buddha didn't teach, oh, you know, every other spiritual said put 10 into your effort. The Buddha said just put 5. That's not it. What the Buddha was talking about is balance. Balancing our lives between being too stringent and too indulgent, between the mind being too energetic and too relaxed, too much effort, too little effort. We're looking for balance. That's what the practice is all about. And the spiritual tools, once you have mindfulness, which is always, the Buddha said, appropriate, no matter what you're doing, bring some awareness within and see what's going on. The rest of the spiritual tools you use selectively to deal with each situation that you can be in. So I'm going to tell you very quickly how to address those 5 states that I've just talked to you about. When the mind is angry, the Buddha said, the best thing to do when we're angry is to cultivate loving kindness, which is the practice we did at the beginning. May I be peaceful. May I be free of stress and suffering. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be... And then bring to mind the person or the people that are bothering the fuck out of you. Remember that you're bringing a lot of the stress and suffering to the situation. Remember that if they're acting unskillfully, it's because they're suffering. And there's no need to add more suffering to the mix, because all that would do is make them act even more unskillfully. Revenge has got to be the stupidest of all the human emotions, because all it does is ensure that there'll be more suffering and more violence and more. The Buddha said, cure for when we've been treated unfairly is forgiveness and loving kindness. So when you feel you've been attacked by the world. There's everybody who wants a piece of you. You're nothing is enough. The best thing to do is to cultivate a sense of first deserving inner peace and serenity for yourself, and then wishing it for the people you perceive as basically the ones who are creating your sense of, even though you're largely creating it, who you associate with being the cause of your suffering. Another skillful thing is forgiveness. And I've given talks on forgiveness, and me and Noah have given talks on forgiveness. But basically the idea is reflecting on the fact that we've all acted unskillfully, forgiving ourselves for times that we've acted unskillfully, and then forgiving the person who we believe is causing us suffering. Both approaches work very well. When there is a sense of craving, a sense that there's nothing enough in the mind, we need to I need to get more from the world. I need to fill my mind up. I feel empty. I feel hollow. One of the things the Buddha taught, first of all, is to practice renunciation, which is reflecting on how whatever it is we're craving, it's not going to fill up your mind. It's not going to make you feel complete. The places that we look to make us feel whole, like for me, I love gadgets. Whenever I'm really stressed out at work, if I forget to do my mindfulness practice, I always invariably find myself on Engadget or one of those sites that have like the cool little media players that are smaller and smaller. And now have you seen it? The iPod Nano is like the size of a button, and it's also cool, and you can wear it on a watch. And I'm like, that will solve all my problems. I hate this job. If only I could have this iPod. I got like 5 iPods. What the fuck? You know? But there's this, you know, there's this sense when there's like, why am I doing this? What's the point of my life? Oh, I know. I'll go to Barney's, or I can't go to Barney's, but somebody who's got more money can. Or, you know, I'll go to, for me, it's Buffalo Exchange, which if you live in Williamsburg, you know about. But, so that sense of I've got to consume, buy, eat, fill myself up. And as Ringo Starr in the Beatles said when he had more money than any other human being could rightfully want to have, and it was 1967 and Sergeant Pepper came out, and he was surrounded by more women than he could possibly sleep with and more drugs that he could possibly do, he said it still wasn't enough. Still wasn't enough. I still felt empty. The Buddha said all the world isn't enough to fill your craving. So reflecting on what will happen when I get this thing? Will it really make me feel like I've got a purpose in life? Will it really make me feel complete? Will this outfit, this pair of pants, the shoes, this thing I'm bidding on, this thing that I think I could get, this nice piece of furniture, this new apartment, whatever, is it really going to solve everything? Probably not. Now, that doesn't mean we can't have goals and we can't buy things or get clothes when we need clothes. But the idea is to let go of that craving energy, that idea that it's going to solve anything. The only thing getting clothes solves is that it puts something on your body when it's cold. But other than that, it's not going to answer anything in your mind. You like my hand movements. So that's one reflection. And the other thing is then, of course, to cultivate a samadhi, a filling meditation within. So that instead of looking for it to be filled without, we cultivate something within. Perhaps it's chanting a thought from the Pali Canon or the metta, the loving kindness phrases or phrases that you picked up from whatever tradition of Buddhism you practice. There's a lot of Theravadan quotes that I use a lot in my meditation. sometimes I'll just listen to talks of Ajahn Jeff, Ajahn Vayamo, Ajahn Amaro. Those have a way of filling up my mind when it feels like I'm missing something, when I feel like there's something that's not there, that there's not enough to life. That really helps me. When the mind feels jumpy, agitated, the most successful strategy is, of course, breath meditation, to cultivate a very long, slow, deep breath. Really, that's the best answer to a jumpy mind. When people are having panic attacks, studies have shown that the thing that makes it so difficult for them to deal with panic attacks is we're hyperventilating. And when we're hyperventilating, the mind gets dizzy, the body becomes more contracted, and the more dizzy and the more you're hyperventilating, the less mindful awareness you have, the less you can calm down and think strategically or get out of the loops of thoughts, of fear, the repetitious thoughts that are causing and re-triggering the panic attacks. So the most skillful thing you can do when you're panicking, when you're agitated, when you're jumpy, is practice finding the breath and taking at least 20 long, slow, deep breaths. You can do that any time in life when you're agitated, you can't calm down, when you feel there's too much on your plate to get done, when you feel like you just can't focus. The breath meditation and relaxing the body as well are the most skillful techniques for bringing calm. When there's a sense of laziness or a sense of stupor or a sense of tiredness in the mind, the Buddha was a hard ass. And one of his recommendations was to reflect on death, which is pretty like going straight for the jugular. The basic idea is remind yourself that you're going to die. And you don't want to die when your mind is totally sluggish and inert and you're not doing anything, lying around in bed, not getting anything accomplished. That was one of his famous things when he'd see monks sort of sleeping. He'd wake them up and say, "You're going to die." I was at a long time ago, I was at a Zen retreat up in the mountains many years ago. And at one point, during the long meditation, somebody out of the blue, and in Zen they never have guided meditations, and you're sitting there facing a wall, so you can get really deep in your own shit and fly away very quickly. And suddenly I heard this voice say, "We humbly remind you that you will die." And it was just like, what the fuck? But the general idea is that if you reflect on the fact that we don't have any guarantees, that any moment could be the last. Do you want this mind that you're in to be the last possible thing that you had, the last experience that you had on earth? Now, there's another thing that you can practice. The Buddha talked also about the three conditions. And I'm not going to teach the three conditions right now, but I will say one of the three conditions is anicca, which means the impermanence of all the things that we experience. Reflecting on impermanence also will do. When you're feeling lazy or uninspired, you can't get the brain motivated. Another thing that also works is to change the breathing, this time for the faster. Sometimes changing the rhythm of the breath can actually, or changing, bringing the energy of the body into the spine can help. The Buddha also mentioned one of my favorite things he said: when sluggish and tired, stand on one leg and recite the Dhamma, which I really expect all of you to be doing at work tomorrow. So, but I do think that reflecting on that we really don't have any guarantees of there being this marvelous future when we can all wake up and achieve happiness. The chance you have for happiness is right now. You don't have any other guarantees. I don't have any other guarantees. So that is a reflection when the mind feels really underworked, energized. With doubt, the Buddha talked about reflecting on the possibility of awakening, which means remember the people in your life who've undertaken a spiritual practice and found peace. Anybody who you've seen who's achieved peace, just reflect on them. Reflect that you in your past have at one point experienced some peace in your life. That it is possible. And that it comes about by your own efforts. That peace is never something that it's not a lottery. It's actually the results of taking skillful actions. Being generous. Being virtuous. Refraining from stealing or saying things that are violent or causing harm through sexuality. Refraining from killing. Refraining from unskillful actions that will, cause shame later on. Practicing goodwill and gratitude and for the things that we've accomplished in life and developing appreciation. I think that to summarize, you see that there's a lot of tools that I've mentioned. I've mentioned everything from working with the breath to reflecting on death and impermanence to renunciation to reflecting on generosity, gratitude, virtue to remembering the Dhamma. All these things. The Buddha said that we have to develop a lot of tools in our lives because the mind suffers in many, many different ways. And if you went to a carpenter, I'll leave with this. If you went to a carpenter who only had one tool in his tool chest, which was a hammer, and he came to build you a bathroom, and his tool chest was a hammer, you probably would feel a little bit concerned. He didn't have any other saw, any other tools. He's just got a hammer. He's like, no, I found that you just need a hammer to do everything that a carpenter needs to do. You'd probably say, well, I'll take your number, and you'd call somebody else. If you went to a doctor, and the doctor had all these shelves, and there was only one kind of medicine on it, for every single ailment, like they used to have in the past, where they just had Dr. Horsehair's magical elixir, like the tonic, that was good for everything. It's good for hair loss and for depression and insomnia. You probably would go, this doctor is not for me. So there's no reason you should have the same type of spiritual practice where the only thing you develop is simply a meditation that's based on the breath, or meditation that's based on metta, or generosity practice, or cultivating virtue, or working with body sensations. Develop as many spiritual tools as you can and use them, because the mind changes and you need to have as many tools as you can to work with the mind. So that's the third foundation of mindfulness, working with citta. Next week, we talk about obsessive thoughts and how to deal with them, how to work with those pesky, awful thoughts that drive us nuts. So thank you so much for listening. If there's any, I have time for a couple of quick questions, so, and then we'll call it a night. So is there any?
Hi. You might have said it, but I didn't say it.
And when the mind feels claustrophobic and tight, generally, the best thing to do is then cultivate body awareness. Just as when, like, for example, your mind is really small and you're worrying about the same thought over and over again, you're filled with doubt or fear, or one thing that you're worried about happening is filling up your mind, then that thought can be, very loud because the mind is only this big. But if the mind is aware of the body, if it's aware of the sounds going on around us, if you expand the mind to bring in as many different sensations as you can, so that the mind becomes the size of this room, then this thought can't make anywhere near as much of a racket. Because you're also aware of all these other things. You have other choices. A mind that's very small is easily overwhelmed and easily, you know, feels rattled. Mm-hmm. So when you give it choices, for example, when I'm getting a tattoo, at first I used to, like, when I was very young, I'd try to push away the pain, and that doesn't work. But I would then, as I got older, I learned how to practice breathing, feeling the other parts of my body, hearing the different sounds of the people talking, you know, becoming aware of as many different things as I could that are skillful, so that I have a choice now. It's not just the needle. I can think about whatever I want. And the Buddha talked about that a mind that's claustrophobic and tiny doesn't have any choice. But if you're, like, worried about something, if you then can bring your awareness into the body, find where the stress is in the body, relax it, then you have different areas that you can pay attention to. You can listen to sounds. The Buddha even said sights of colors and things like that we can become aware of. Anything that makes the mind larger. Mm-hmm. Start with the body, though.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.